truck. So what happens is you send in some quantum, you know, you've got some interaction region, and stuff goes flying off. So that, in a way, is convenient because out of here and out of here, we've got three fields. These are essentially free fields. So, what you can do is a perturbative series that tells you how to calculate those final free fields in terms of the initial free field, and some interaction that takes place in some fairly small region, actually. So, in terms of, you know, the general problem, almost what he tried to set up here. You know, it really works much better than it sounds like, because the interaction region is, you know, where the protons collide in an accelerator or something, that stuff goes flying off. So, what we do is we write the Hamiltonian for the system as some free Hamiltonian plus an interaction Hamiltonian. For example, let's look at a Dirac particle coupled to electromagnetism. Right, so we've got pi bar I d flash minus m phi, and we have our electromagnetic action. And this describes the free field. I d flash minus m time r describes a free Dirac field. And then there's one more term sitting in here that I a flash, depends whether you put an extra I in there. Probably best with an extra I. So let's maybe call it minus 5r a flash phi. This thing is the interaction. So the Hamiltonian that comes from the free Dirac action and the free electromagnetic action would be H0. And the interaction term is just this one thing where you've got the combination of a photon and your electron thing. And that's responsible for all the difference between the free fields here and the free fields here, because in some region here, you've got electromagnetic fields. And so or maybe it's electromagnetic fields coming in and you've got some charges in there. So maybe the electrons would go to be either way. Constant scattering, for example, would be that situation where you send a photon into every source of electrons like a hunk of plastic. And, you know, hydrogen is that pretty good electron to nucleon ratio there. And and you get scattering. The electron and the photon go flying off, having interchanged some energy and momentum. All right, so another example that's actually really good for pedagogical purposes, like helping me remember this stuff, is 5-4 theory. You can look at a scalar field and take an interaction term that is usually written with a convenient normalization, and the field to the fourth power. So your normal Klein-Gordon field has a mass squared times phi squared, and you've got this dumb version, you know, the gradient squared. And you add something like this that causes interactions between the free phi fields, two phi quanta can scatter off one another because of a term like this. So, yeah, 5-4, you could have a couple of phi particles coming in and a couple going out, so it could produce some kind of a scattering.
of those particles. All right, so to do this, the thing we want to do is characterize these free states by some initial and final cause or kin. And what we're looking for is the amplitude you get if you evolve the system. If we look at the time dependence of A, we have the Hamiltonian times time acting on some initial state. And this is really T minus some initial time, which is probably going to go to minus infinity. And then we want to look at how that interacts with B at T final. So what we end up looking at is either minus I over H bar H times basically T final minus T initial and A. So this will be the scattering amplitude that we're interested in for various possible final states B and various initial stuff coming in. You know, this is what will tell us the probability of measuring various things B. And we want to develop a systematic perturbation theory for calculating these. And it's going to get messy. One way to approach this, you can think of this as a final state, and you can write that final state as some operator S acting on A matrix operator. This is appropriately called the S matrix. This is the matrix that we named,
Final
probably for scattering.
The final state is that operator you have
S,
with the A
S. Cat? Yeah, it's all of that stuff to the right.
Okay.
So if we can compute the S matrix, then we've basically solved the problem. Another thing that happens here is most of the stuff misses. So it's really handy to write S as 1 plus I times T and calculate things as T. Because the stuff that misses, you just get the identity. Well, you want to subtract that off anyway. You're only interested in the stuff that actually scatters. And some of that being kind of teaches that pretty directly anyway. And then there are some useful identities involving T that let you very simply assess some other things that go on. I'll show you what I mean in a little more detail in a minute. Let's see. He words this very awkwardly. let me just... Deriving the identity operator here, and what he means to be proving that S is unitary. But we get conservation of probability. So what we want is A to be normalized to 1. And we want final state to be normalized to 1 as well. So we also want this to be true. This will happen if S is unitary. You can show it both ways. I'm not convinced that he's done that here. But S dagger S is S dagger. And
this expresses the conservation.
Fearless.
Yeah.
I want to hear about that.
I was joking. Well,
that's really scary. That's a bigger grid. The group doubled in size one day. Does that mean we're going to have 12 on Friday? Scary
thought. Well, Sita's gone for sure.
What's that?
Sita's gone for sure, isn't he?
Yeah. Okay. So, this condition, right? You can do this expanding at the dagger. So, what do you need? You want the scattering matrix to be unitary. And if you substitute, then find out a condition for T. I don't know if T actually has a name. But, S is 1 plus T, and S dagger S is going to be 1 minus I dagger. So that's that's just what, twice the imaginary part of the trace of D is equal to, let me see if I'm writing it the same way.
Wait, so you get the trace as you're coming over a set of D's?
Yeah, go ahead and summarize.
Like,
quit.
Take A, B, and
you
like every element
in
a complete
set of statements.
No, sorry, don't sum. Don't sum. Just in the imaginary part of a diagonal element is going to be the sum of all of the off diagonal stuff. So we have a sum on N of, this becomes, that just becomes P squared. So, the diagonal element can give you information about the squares of the off-diagonal, the probabilities off-diagonal. And that turns out to be a useful relationship. You can conclude stuff about.
So, if A equals B, then it didn't scatter at all? Or
well,
okay.
Or it might have scattered twice, I suppose. you could have multiple interactions. So the final state being the same as the initial doesn't mean nothing happened.
Oh, okay, right.
So what we're doing here, because we're not really putting the S matrix between A and B, we're putting S dagger S between A and B, right? So there's this another thing we're computing with here that we need a.
This is the scattering matrix. This is the useful relationship on the T matrix.
Okay.
Where diagonal elements tell you something about off diagonal elements. It's excuse me. It's feel really noisy. it's not something that is direct information about the scattering, it's just information about P, which then tells you about the scattering. Now, the next thing we need, I think, is the Heisenberg representation. So, let's remember a little bit about the relationship between the Heisenberg and the Schrodinger. And here, I need to take a little care to get this line right. In the Schrodinger picture, it's the state that evolves. So, a state A, you can think of as some A of T. In the Heisenberg picture, it's the operators that evolve. Well, in field theory, the fields are the operators. And it's useful to think of them as being the thing that evolves. So, may go back and forth some between, so far as this is Schrodinger picture, but we can compute something like VSA. We can write that quantity in either Schrodinger or Heisenberg. It's the same. It's going to be the same number in the end. It's just a matter of what we associate the time dependence with. So, where are we picture wise?
Everything's okay.
You got it? Okay. Let's start back over here. Joe, you need to change your name to Jeff. And we got two of everybody.
Or I need to change my name to Joe.
Yeah. Or you could both be Joe-F or something.
Joe-F.
Sure.
Joe-F. Wow. This is not good. Maybe it's just your Monday. Hi. Yeah. Happy New Year.
Yeah, thanks.
good to see it. You have a good break?
Yeah, it's all right. I have a question about the operators. So the fields are the operators, but now I can't remember what are the fields they're acting on. What are our states?
The states are built up from the vacuum state. So in the things we've quantized, our states are states. We deal with them. All right, we have field operators, which can be re-expressed in terms of A's and A daggers, where these depend on momentum, certainly, and quite possibly spin, some sort of spin quantum numbers. And these are operators, according to. We define the vacuum to be the state that goes zero if you annihilate it. Right? You act with any lowering operator, and you can't take any particles away. Right? So if there were some particles here with that momentum and that spin, this would give you something. It gives you one fewer particle. But if it gives zero, there weren't any in there, so that's correct. And this is for all momenta and spin. So you want there to be no particles in it. And this seems straightforward. It certainly is straightforward for the simple harmonic oscillator. It's not bad for scalar fields. I ran this for scalar fields in curved space, and it's unimaginably complex for gravity. Defining a consistent space state for gravity, you run into problems with ghosts, for example. You can have all sorts of issues about the existence of negative Planck states, and defining a coherent space state can be a real hurdle. But then particle states. Are those you get by acting with any number of A daggers acting on the vacuum. So this is a state that has n particles in it with momenta p1 through pn and spins f1 through fn. So these are going to be our states coming in and going out of interaction. So these are exactly the states we're going to be dealing with. And this question actually sets up the problem that I want to wrestle our way through today. This matrix element. From an initial state A to a state B, we would like to write that starting with A being something with n particles and B being something with m particles. We'd like to re-express that in terms of the fields and the vacuum state. So we know how to write an n particle state here as a bunch of A daggers acting on the vacuum. And those A daggers can be written in terms of the field. And we can do the same on this end. So eventually we're going to transform this, as it looks by the end of the day. Vacuum state sandwiching, the answer turns out to be a time-ordered product of fields in here. So
we'll work our way to that expression. That's our goal for the immediate future. Before the immediate future, I'm going to do this Heisenberg thing. Okay, so, yeah, good question. And follow-up?
Does
this answer your question?
Yeah, first part. But there's another one, I think.
Okay.
I just came up with them. So our states have the momentum and the spin, and so those are some kind of particle. Where is the field now? I thought, should I think of the field as the particle, or should I think of this particle being some other entity which has this spin and momentum, or are they kind of intertwined in some way that's undiscernible?
Where is the particle? Where is the field?
Are they the same thing? Are they, I mean, I know like wave packet.
They're the same thing.
Okay.
Right. The field is quantized. So if we make measurements of the field, if the field is in this state, the field's an operator, but we've used that operator to produce this state. Alright, so we measure this state, but we're gonna measure one of those momenta and one of those spins. So that's what's gonna happen. Or we act on this with a number operator and we're gonna count how many particles there are in it. That is the manifestation, insofar as we can measure it, of the field. I made that sentence up right on the spot.
Right on the fourth.
That's all right. This is really, the thing that quantum field theory does is produces these quanta of the field. It's a puzzling thing about quantum theory that, it would all make pretty good sense. You get this evolution and stuff, and then you try and make a measurement, and it's some of this all or nothing thing. Right? And you either measure a particle or you don't. You don't measure all that oscillation that, in the Fourier expansion of this, things are oscillating now. You get a particle. And, so think about it and tell us why. Nice homework, Andrew.
I'll get back in 10 years.
Yeah. Why do you have to measure the whole thing? Okay. So, back to Schrodinger. So, Schrodinger. Operators in state. We have state, and I don't like this notation. I like to write AFT as the time dependent state. Maggiore writes state A and put the T out here for some reason. That's changed. So, different strokes, this is the time evolved initial state. And really, there's a T initial floating around somewhere. A, and figuratively we know this is A of T initial, but think of that as some fixed given thing. And now, let me put a subscript S on here so we know that Schrodinger, and then we can find Heisenberg state. The Heisenberg state is going to be and point out that it's actually a good idea to include that initial time because it's hiding in there. And we'll see a little bit more about that in a bit. But you take away that time dependence.
So what you end up with is just the Schrodinger state at the initial time. Only this is the Heisenberg state at all times. That doesn't change. What changes is the operator. So for operators, suppose we're looking at some expectation value like I just erased. So let's see, if we have some operator acting on A of T, or an expectation value of the operator like this in the Schrodinger picture. Like, what is that? Well, that's D e to the plus I h, and suddenly abruptly setting h bar to 1, since we've been doing that all lecture. So I'll stop writing h bar. See. Then we have Schrodinger e to the minus I h t a. Well, how are we doing on sine? Good. We can just take that to be the Heisenberg operator. And it depends on time. This is the Heisenberg state. It's the A without the time dependence. So this same expression is the Heisenberg, O Heisenberg T, operator A. So the two things are the same. You write the very same thing, but you're just putting the time dependence into a different place. This turns out to be useful for interactions. There's actually something halfway in between called the interaction picture, where what you do is you put, I forget which way it goes now. You put the time dependence of the free field Hamiltonian into the state, and you put the interaction time dependence into the operator, or vice versa. I forget which way it goes. But that's called the interaction picture. And I'm sorry, he doesn't talk about it yet. I haven't thought about it in a while. But, you can find it in Sackrosh, for example. He talks about the interaction picture.
Is that useful? Or?
It's really useful because you know the full solution is the free problem. And so you go ahead and use that full time dependent solution to the free problem. And then you treat the time dependent interaction perturbatively, and so you want to have that separated out. So you get rid of the time dependence that would be the time evolution of the free particle. Just do your perturbation theory on that difference. So that's a useful picture too. Let's see. Okay, the reason, here's where we get to the reason for keeping this, where have I got it? Yeah, here. The reason for keeping the TI here. We're going to be expanding expressions in terms of eigenstates, those from operators, especially the Hamiltonian, but in terms of whatever operator. And the if we have some operator at some initial time, and that acts on some Heisenberg state A at the initial time and gives us the eigenvalue A, those same states, A Heisenberg, suppose we were just going to write A Heisenberg. Well, that operator changes. So O of some general T acting on that Heisenberg state is not equal to A, H, if T is not equal to TI in general, right? Because the operator has changed.
Having put the time dependence into the operator, your original set of eigenstates of that operator at a certain time are no longer eigenstates of the time dependence. So, Maggiore, wisely, keep track of, by putting that TI in there, it's telling you what operator these are eigenstates of. It's part of the specification of, oh, this was an eigenstate of that operator.
T is different from TI, right?
Thank you, Mom. Yeah. If those were the same, then it was better.
It's always useful to leave out the crucial symbol. Okay. So, let's see. What else do I need to say about that? You can do a T final one too. So our final state. See, why is that? He emits the H just at the point when I want it. But he wants to write the final state in the Heisenberg representation. Okay, the way you get the Heisenberg state from the Schrodinger state is to multiply by the inverse of that operator, so e to the plus I H be final, acting on the Schrodinger state B of T. We'll give you the Heisenberg state at the final time. So the thing we're after, B T final on A T initial, this is just the test matrix A. So
Maybe
no, that's just what I was fussing about. Notice what you do. If I've got A of T, the time of evolution comes with a minus, like this, for the Schrodinger picture. So if I want to get the Heisenberg picture from that, a Heisenberg is e to the plus IHT on A of T Schrodinger. So that's the reason it's plus here.
But I'm wondering, isn't there some, don't you think as it would be used to find the exponential, it's because we're acting on the Schrodinger state, it's trying to be, doesn't that need to go somewhere into the operator we're putting on it? This is the next one now. Because we have the Schrodinger state of time T, doesn't that T need to be some kind of exponential?
Oh, I see. Let's call this T final. To get rid of a general T, we need a general T up here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So, take the Schrodinger state at T final. Does that do it? This will get rid of the factor on that one. Okay. You would need a general T to get rid of the general T. Okay. So now let's attack this reduction formula. Before I launch into this, what are everybody's time constraints? We just did this on Monday, but
We should probably do it again since there seems to be a two-day doubling going on. We usually just go. It seems that this semester the cows come home at 4:20. Because one has to be somewhere. And, you know, we just go till then. What we usually do, I dropped it some last semester, but sometimes we just talk about research stuff, and sometimes we just want to field theory, and I don't know how you guys want to balance that. Want you to be able to talk about research stuff too. But, I don't know, any thoughts on that? Any other time constraints other than we start at 2:30 and, you know, go until we all look kind of droopy? Okay.
I might be taking another class at 2:30, but it's just not this week, and I'm not ready to take this class in advance.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Are we going to be posting audio and video stuff?
I have those last ones still.
Yeah, well, that's okay. I'm not trying to rush you. I'm just, you know, for Nathan's benefit.
Right.
We post on the web everything. So
I might want to do your half this
message. Oh, really? Okay. So, yeah, get what you like. That's fine. I don't know. Make progress in field theory. If you guys come in with research questions, you know, we might find ourselves dealing with research questions. That's fine. You know, I've got this room Monday, Wednesday, Friday from 2:30 on, so we have plenty of time to discuss whatever we want. You know, go get you 3 hours a week of field theory for sure. Okay, so back to the problem I stated at the beginning. We want to look at this expression where A and B stand for a whole bunch of momenta. And just for concreteness and simplicity, I'm going to use the symbol for a scalar field. The situation, we'll go through direct fields too, but the situation won't be terribly different for other fields. And the whole thing is relatively sensitive, so I'm going to keep staring at the book.
The last line you drew here is that's just the definition of S. That's what we said in the beginning, is it's the difference between the final and initial fields. So
right. This is still up here somewhere, I guess. Spanish, but S was the time evolution from T initial to T final, and so if we put those into the Heisenberg states, we're talking Heisenberg states over here, somewhere there ought to be hanging there, and then this was the Schrodinger picture.
Okay. So the S has no time dependence in it, but the here. On the right side of the equation, the B's do?
Yeah. Now, we can define an S sub H.
Okay.
S sub S gets a little... S sub H would be putting time dependence in that.
Okay.
It's an operator, so we can do it the same as any S.
So, one more question.
Yes.
So, in theory, this is like an infinite dimensional matrix, then? If A and B are different particles, then, or...?
Well, let's see. It could be. It certainly could be. But in a typical collider experiment, you get a quark on an anti-quark probability, probability for up on anti. In a PP bar collider, but you've got. All right. Sorry. Digression. You've got an up-up-down colliding with an up-bar-up-bar-down-bar. What's the probability that when they actually collide, what you're looking at is a UU-bar collision? That should be easy. But it's some integer over 9. Some of the numbers involved are just divisible by three.
Okay. Exercise if you wake up at 4 in the morning and can't sleep. Okay. We're interested in these things. So, you know, this is our A, the TI. That's just the form that it'll take. And we're going to deal with scalar fields, so we don't need the spins that spin zero.
That's okay.
Okay.
Yes.
And the thing we want to do is, we're going to take the long time limit. So ultimately, we take Ti to minus infinity and T final to plus infinity. And don't run into problems, because that probably simplifies things, actually. What else? Real scalar field. So, we want to invert this, and now we need one of the expressions we derived last time, and I suppose we could just trust in that, right, or if you've got your notes. We solved for A and A dagger for a scalar field last term. You remember that was part of computing the commutation relations or anti-commutation relations of the grade mean lower operators. We had to invert the Fourier theory to find the relevant commutation relations, the very simple commutation relations satisfied by AA dagger by 2 by cube delta. Mm-hmm. That came out to be rack delta. But
come on.
My cell is dead.
Oh.
So to
say, take mine and call me when it's time to go.
Yeah.
Okay. When are we done today? Do you have to go up for 20?
For 20. Yeah.
Did you want to meet Jeff after?
I'm thinking I'm good, but
you good? Anybody else need to meet after 4:20? Why don't you just bring background for
4:30. Okay.
Root 2k. Okay. T and k are interchangeable because h bar is 1. So we had a normalization that gave us. Can you write this with a subscript? Okay. So it's probably believable. Oh, I don't know. It'd be nice to go check this with what we had last time. But B3 is
epsilon to B3 minus epsilon to H4 is
the
track. Time derivative of the free field minus the derivative the other way
So what's that going to do? Pull down a plus I omega.
I have it in terms of phi and pi. So the first one is pi, right?
So e to the minus I k x. So then we have a pi minus I omega phi. That was a little more like what we were writing.
Yeah.
Is that what we had?
Are we doing scalar field here?
Scalar field, yeah.
Okay.
Sorry,
I did this last time.
Here. He uses a funny signature. This is certainly close to what we were writing. So let's go with this and exercise check it. So exercise fill in the details in any calculation that rubs you the wrong way. All right. So now. The trick here is that we've got these fields. There's a bunch of stuff I've got to say to make this all right. We want to write the free field. We're going to let phi free go to the phi in or phi out, the initial or the final field, as I said before, they're free fields. We need a constant here, and he refers to Weinberg for the reason that I think I can tell you why there's this constant. So there's a square root of a z here on each of these.
What is z?
That's just a big capital letter z. It's a constant. It's just some constant. I don't know why it's called a z. But the thing that happens when you set up the scattering is, you know, remember we've got this 1 plus I t thing, acting on our initial state, our phi in state to produce the outgoing phi. And what happens is, the thing you're interested in is what T does to phi in. But then you also end up with a phi in as part of the out state. And this is, in some sense, most of it, that T is, in some appropriate sense, a law. So you'd like this to be normalized, but it can't be if you're going to add this to it. So you square this thing, and this thing's almost one, but not quite. So you need this z to correct for the normalization. I'm pretty sure that's the reason it's in there. Metieri doesn't go into it, but there is that normalization thing that I think is what gets right up front. So we do that. And then we... Yeah?
So these phi fields that are in the anthropic here, those are our operators, right?
Yeah, these are all operators. So we could put hats here and here.
And these phi states right here are eigenvectors, operators?
Yeah. Those are, well,
The initial operator is a free field operator. Let's see.
Back to my question, right?
These days I probably should have called them A&B or something like that. But yeah, this is going to have a whole bunch of factors of A dagger acting on the back end of what this is. So this is a bunch of A daggers acting. And if those are Heisenberg A daggers, it's not the same A daggers that you're going to use to produce the acetate. So, you know, this is why I'm crawling through this. You know, I just. It's a lot to keep track of, but what we want to do is take that transition amplitude here and write this as first a bunch of A daggers acting on the vacuum. We've got to be a little careful what we mean by those vacuum operators, because as I said, the initial state A daggers are different than the final state A daggers, so not the same guys. We want to pull out all the A daggers from both sides, or A's if they're daggers, and then re-express those A dagger things as fine, as field operators. Well, that's a little tricky because the field isn't just A dagger. You know, the field and the conjugate field are. So in order to get the field, you need a linear combination of those two different operators. And we'll be able to build the right combination, but that's sensitive. So, here we go. That's the reason for the normalization. We replace the free states in these expressions, and we get some A dagger in and some A dagger out here, corresponding to the free fields in the asymptotic region. Now, what happens next? So we've got an A dagger in. Some definitions like this. By 1/2, then we've got, let's say, from A, K, dagger, in. Right, what is that? Well, this 5-free is going to be replaced by root Z, so we're going to have a root Z floating around here somewhere. Then e to the minus I kx, and our crazy mixed up differentiation acting on phi n. So now we've made that substitution. And similarly, we have a dagger out.
Asking about the partial with the double arrow.
This means you act on it to the right minus the operator acting on the same.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that is
okay.
Yeah, I would have done well to remind. If you've got any two functions, f and g, like this, could be any derivative operator we like. It's f, d, g minus df.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So in this case, it's just time differentiation.
Okay.
I thought I had totally forgotten the notation from last semester, right? But the IKX, is that a three-dimensional or four-dimensional dot there? Yeah. Is there even any time difference? Kind of dependence to differentiate? So, but that really does turn into the kind of thing we had last semester. Okay. I think, yeah, this all looks good. Oh, wait. Now, the one thing I've forgotten is that the T here needs to be the instate T. So let me do it again. I need more room. Minus I root T. And then we can do it as a limit as T goes to, this would be minus infinity for the instate. It's now the integral d3x of e to the, sorry, ikx minus ikx d0. Fine. So. And similarly for phi out. So the limit for phi out, of course, is t goes to plus infinity. Okay. I think we're ready to start and just extract one of these things. Yeah.
Here's what we need.
T1 to T, let me get my numbers the same, Tn at T prime. And then let's call it K1 through KM at T initial. Right, that's the matrix element we want to compute. And we can, let's see, we're going to pull out K1. Why?
Are these keys also momentum?
Momentum, the independent momenta here and here, but yeah, they're
okay.
H bar K is P, so H bar is 1, so it's just a different name for the P.
Okay.
So M particles coming in, N particles coming out, a ridiculously general place to start. We should probably do it with just two, but what we're really going to do is operate on one of these. We're going to write this as, what do we have, 2EK1, 1/2, and then an A dagger. Let's get a normalization on that basic state of 2E. I didn't remember that from last semester. Okay, he writes the following, T1 through Tn, final, and then an A K1 dagger at T1 acting on K2 through KM at T initial. So he writes that he has this normalization in his definition of the space of state. Maybe we can certainly normalize them any way we want. Presumably that's the right thing to do. But
I think we had the same one. It was just that it was buried on one term. Because we had like a root 2 over E on the other side.
Yeah, we solved for these guys, so we were dividing by that.
Right.
That's what we did. Because we were computing commutation relations to these.
Right.
We quickly sketched the way to produce states, but I don't think we checked the normalization of those states. So presumably we needed a risk to the just normalization of the state, right? Not obviously me one way or the other, but
I see.
Probably we'll go with that. Okay. Now
to express this in terms of the field is the next trick. So we invoke our formula, and so far, just straightforwardly invoke the formula, and then we need to do some tricks. So we've got factors here. This is our tangent, right here. So we have a minus I root 3. Then we have a limit. T goes to minus infinity. And it'll be x. Factor is minus I a x. This is a 1x. Then 1 to pn t final. Now g0 by n, and then k2 through km. So far, so good. Now, we get a tricky bit. This derivative and that integral are three-dimensional, not four-dimensional, and we want to make this covariant. And so we use a cute trick. Let's see if we believe the following. Limit t goes to infinity minus the limit as t goes to minus infinity of the integral of d3x f of dx. The integral over dt over all time of d dt of the three-state integral. So let's see, does that make sense? So if we just had an indefinite integral here, we go from t1 to t2, we take the limit as it goes to infinity, so we get the improper integral, and that all seems okay. And now we've produced something that really looks like a four-dimensional integral out of this. And it's a cute trick, because what it means is that this difference here is going to pick up the double arrow for it. So this expression is going to turn into something just like that. Okay, does this, everything make sense for everybody? Questions?
We have three different time values, capital TF, capital TI, and little t. So when, like, for instance, that differential with the double arrow on top of it, the partial, is that, what is that taking the derivative with respect to? Little t?
Okay, remember this operator is little t dependent.
Okay.
And that x is
little t.
Little t.
Okay.
So that's what we differentiate here.
Okay.
And then we're going to take that time to infinity.
Okay.
You're integrating also overall space, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, this will be all space.
Okay.
So the whole space dependent.
Okay,
Joe, question? Okay. Nathan, one. I'm going to
say once, right?
That's
the beauty of it.
Yeah. Nathan, one, Joe, squared? No, I'm not going to keep doing that. Let's see. So, you know, what we want is
the function to be that minus I with that integrand. So, you know, just the extra stuff here. So let's f of the minus I then minus I k 1 x d0 phi n, I think.
Is it getting all right there? 1 over root 3.
I don't want to overroot these. Do I have it in the wrong place there?
That one should have been 1 over root C. Yeah. Back here.
This should have been 1 over root C.
So, I want to put phi in here. Yeah, phi 3 is root z, phi n, so I need to divide by the root z to end up with phi n. Did I say that sensibly? No. I don't feel like what's going on. Blast. Where did we get the minus there? So if we replace what is that? Does anybody see it? I thought we'd done that right. But he has 1 over root C here. which of this is crazy?
Are we supposed to think of this in this thing over here, are we supposed to think of this site in somehow corresponding to the site B over there? So that what we really have is going to say like 1 over root C by 3 or 3 site in.
Yeah, I mean, you're saying exactly what my confusion is. Yeah, if we just do this substitution for phi 3, we get a root 3. But what he's writing is 1 over root 3, so that's clearly not the way he's thinking about it. And he doesn't tend to be overly explicit, so we just have to figure it out.
Is it a feasible one, or is it?
No, it's just a fancy thing.
Oh, okay.
A little big on the fancy. okay. We can define z to be 1 over z if we want, so it doesn't make any difference. It's just a constant. He wants the constant in the denominator here, so let's put it there.
So this should be 1 over z up here, then? Is that what we're saying?
I would say, yeah. otherwise, I don't quite see how we're thinking about it. So let's do it. Then here we have 1 over z, and everywhere. So then we absorb that 1 over z as part of our function. And so we're going to have another time derivative of this funny thing, which is okay. So what's going to happen is this stuff. And this and that are going to be what? There's
it's still going to be there. We're just going to get another time derivative here and a d4x there, and I'm not sure anything else is particularly different. Except for sine. So, t goes to minus infinity. Oh, I think you reversed the order. All right, so here's the next plan. 2ek to 1/2. And now we want to get to, oh, okay. So, essentially he's choosing this a dagger for the integrand of the a dagger as an x. So, if we write this expression, these two limits are going to give us an a in and an a out. All right, the t goes to infinity limit is actually going to give us an a out dagger. And then we subtract the a in dagger from the second limit. And that's now going to be equal to, on this side, a d4x, d0, of our f, where our f is all this stuff. So, minus I over root v, and then either minus I, k, dot x, derivative psi n. So, we can, it's a key trick that lets us replace the field by not one but two A daggers here. And the thing that saves us is one of those is going to die because it will be acting on at the wrong time. It involves an assumption, but it's not a daunting assumption. I just want to see if we've gotten a, we've gotten a d4x. I over root z, and he puts this sign over on the other side, so he's got a in minus a. Okay, so, how are we doing? Everybody good up here? Okay.
Oh, where's the bra cat?
Right, this is just some identity stuff.
Oh, okay.
So we need to substitute this into here. So what can we replace? The under bracketed stuff in this expression is going to be now replaced by this difference of A.
Quick question.
Doesn't do anything weird with the sign.
Quick question on the double on the derivative thingy. Okay. What's that? Is it acting on the ket bra at the left over here? Or?
No. Those are time independent. It's acting on the ket up here.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Right. Just like it was over in the original.
Okay. So there's a t in there as well.
Yeah, so this is one function of t, this is another function of t, and that's all of the...
Okay.
Questions in there? Anybody else happy enough? Yes?
Yep.
Yeah? Okay. So, is that what it turns into? Oh, we're going to play with this, I see. So, let's look at this one. Yeah, we can do some stuff with that. Okay, so if we look at d4x of this time derivative of the time derivative thing, minus ikx. Phi. And it's phi, and I think we're done with that. Now, here, we're going to turn this into something akin to the field equation. Let's see. Yeah. We're going to write it out and then just use the field equation. So, nothing too fancy, just before x. Then, we have a term d0 e to the I kx minus phi kx d0 phi n, and another term, there are too many derivatives acting here. Sorry, let's do this one at a time. Okay, so we have a difference here, and when we take this one, the terms where you have one time derivative on each thing are going to cancel. So you'll just get second time derivatives. That's what's happening here. But let me just do it in a couple steps. So we have d0 e to the minus I, oops, wrong way, e to the minus I kx, d0 phi n, minus d0 e to the minus I kx, phi n. And now, the next step, we get some cancellation. So when this hits that, cancels with the term when this hits that. So the only things we have are the second derivative terms, either minus I, k, x, d0 squared, phi n, minus d0 squared, either minus I, k, x, phi n. There. And this looks like a piece of a field equation. We have the second time derivative of phi. The time derivative d0 squared is e to the minus I k x. Right? What is that? Okay, this is minus k dot x plus I omega plus omega t, right? So, two time derivatives will pull down minus I omega squared becomes minus omega squared. Like this. But, right, what we know from the fine Gordon equation, box minus m squared phi, is there are, well, for a plane wave, that would be zero. And the box, let's see, what do we have now? I have to keep reversing the signature in my head. But so we're going to get a minus omega squared plus del squared of minus I k x. Let's see, minus m squared either minus I k x is zero. And so the minus omega squared term is m squared minus del squared. So, yeah. Looks like the sign is, So let's see. So minus, this says minus omega squared e to the minus ikx.
of the pump, the Coulomb-Berchon operation is really given negative omega squared with minus tau squared. Because of my signature.
Oh, yeah, plus minus.
Yeah.
All
right. Oh, that can't be associated with anything. It should be plus M in the signature. What sign do we want here? Yeah, that's a plus. Yeah, okay, so if it was a pure, you know, if we had a pure e to the minus I mass times time, then two times derivatives is going to pull down, you'll get minus mass squared, so you need to be adding mass to solve this for stationary components. So, quick check, we got this. So we have plus here, minus there, thank you all. And this then becomes equal to del squared minus m squared, operating on e to the minus I, okay, x. So we make that replacement in our integral. Let me just continue across here with that input to write integral d for x. And then minus I a x d0 squared phi n minus L squared minus M squared U minus I A X. Quantum field theory is made up of an infinite sequence of tricks. No, because right, the term in parentheses here without the sign is what I wrote up here. It pulls down an I squared, so we get a minus.
Yeah, but this L squared and M squared stuff is
that.
Already has the negative sign.
So we want one. Okay.
No, sorry. You're right.
It's easier if I'm right.
You're right.
Okay, good. All right.
So there's an extra phi n.
And there's a phi here, right?
Phi n, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Now what? So we've used the four vector thing. That's fine. Okay. Now we integrate by parts twice. So what we're going to do is, between this and two integrals by parts of this, we're going to get a box on phi. I don't dare erase anything. let me squeeze in here. So let's give this thing a name. This is some integral. So I don't want to lose this yet. So our integral is equal to d4x. Don't have room to write our integral. Make room. Okay, can you see what's going to happen? Each integration by parts changes the sign once, so we're still going to have minus del squared, so this does look like a box. Surface terms off at infinity, we take the vanish. We'll let our field vanish at infinity, the usual assumptions there. And so box is, just have this thing to define, it's a plus dt squared. So this is just a plain box. So e to the minus I k x box phi n, then plus m squared phi n. And we have a nice covariant expression, which you might think is zero, but no. We're going to sum over all field configurations. Remember this thing sitting inside the path integral. We do not impose the field equation until the end. So that's not true. We can do this thing for all phi. And then do our perturbation theory. In quantum theory, you don't know what phi is. right, if you're not measuring it, you don't know what the field is. So what we're measuring are these end states. In between, I can be doing anything. And in fact, it's doing everything. Right? The experimental results are consistent with, oh, everything that possibly can happen will. Phrase, but this company said that. It stuck. Okay. All right. So that's starting to look a little tidier. We still have, okay, so we've just worked with this expression. We still have a minus I, z to the minus half here. And then that integral. So we substitute that into this expression here. So what I want to do is erase enough of this calculation that I can write the next line of our main calculation. We need to work all around the side. Okay. So lose that until we've got it all. What does this mean? I'm going to change that sign. And to compensate, I will change the order of these two. So I think we still have this 2 to the k1 to the 1 half. Good. And then we're going to replace all of this integral stuff with, let's see, we took the limit to get the a. So this limit we've now taken. So we have a d4x. We have a box for m squared that's going to act on that phi. And then we have our p1 through pn, the final. And then all of this integral stuff got replaced by, I put a sign in this, I still got the root, so I need a in dagger minus a out dagger. And then the k states, k2 through k m t initial.
So why do we have a dagger? Isn't a dagger evaluating the integral? If we did, didn't we evaluate, isn't it integral we did with doing that box
that
we did?
Okay. Hang on. What did we do? The
don't we want like G in right there? Good expansion.
Oh, I'm combining sorry. Let's do it this way. This is equal, to those guys on the other side with the box stuff. So, all right, let's see, what am I replacing? Yes, we replace all of this integral and the limit with the a minus a dagger.
Without an integral.
Right, without an integral, yeah, okay, start. So, there we go. 2EK1. Yeah, I was confounding this half of the equation with the other half. So, P1 through PN, T final, and now A in dagger minus A out dagger. K1, K2, we got rid of one of them. Now we have to do this m plus n times. K, m, t, initial. All of that is equal to, so here's the left side of this. The right side of that we now can write with this integral. So, and I've taken a one sign. So I over root 2. And then d4x. Box plus m squared. And then a
apply in this same position. So T1 through TN, T final, phi N, K1 through KM, the initial,
K2
that would be the whole point. Yeah. Let me check this. We agree with the expression here. So I over the square root. We're getting it here. Oh, e to the minus 5 kx. I lost. There's still this exponential here. That's right here. Nope. Wrong line. Where are we? Here. Okay. So here we are. We've successfully removed one of the momenta from this expectation vacuum, and we've replaced it by our wave operator acting on an expectation of the field. So you see where we're going to get to here. We're going to pull out all of these. So we've got to do this m plus n times. Then we're going to have a product of n plus m fields in here between vacuum states. Those are Green's functions. Right? Or another word for them is n plus m correlation function. Right? So expectation values of products of the fields. Once we know those basic objects, then we can act with some derivative things, do m plus n times 4 integrals, and we've calculated a transition amplitude. This side simplifies a little bit because, an acting on this. Now let's see, which one of these goes away? An A-in dagger acting on a time initial vacuum state can create a particle. That's good. An A-out dagger, which way is that?
That would delete a particle on the final state.
That would delete a particle on the final state, but the question is, the times of these guys. Got it. Yeah. This would delete a particle of momentum K1 from the final state. We assume there is no particle of momentum K1 in the final state. Okay, that's not too radical. If there is, some particle just went through and didn't interact. So we're going to assume that all particles in the system actually interacted and changed their momentum. It's not too radical. It can be fixed up if you need to. What that amounts to in terms of Feynman diagrams is that we're only talking about connected diagrams. So we've got a bunch of lines coming in, some interaction, a bunch of lines going out. There could be a piece over here where K1 goes to K1. We're not dealing with that. So a disconnected piece of the diagram doesn't count. We're only looking at connected Feynman diagrams here. So then, because of because of that, this A out annihilating a K1 state here vanishes.
Yeah. What happens though if two interactions, say the particle one of the K2 came out?
Well, it could.
You could really
I'm thinking that maybe zero by the time you integrate over all momentum. I'm not sure. I don't know. That could be a resonant thing that's important. So we should keep it in mind. That can't happen. And I don't know if it gives an important contribution or not. I can think of some situations where it does, you know, resonance absorption or emission. You send in a photon of momentum K1, and just the presence of the oscillation of just the right frequency near the atom stimulates emission of another photon of the same momentum. I don't know, did that participate? So, you know, there are some things to worry about here. And, you know, is there any scattering of the first photon and a stimulated emission? Anybody know offhand?
They go in the same direction, right? Sure.
You know, they used to build laser bulbs,
right? Exactly.
So they end up really parallel. Now, is that exactly parallel or, you know, really parallel enough for practical purposes? I don't know offhand. So we keep that thought in the back of our head. So the next thing to do is iterate this, but it's being 420 and are having reached a stable point. I think it's a good time to leave the room or turn to a quench or whatever. Yeah, we got through it. That wasn't it. That was pretty funky calculation. You notice it's going back and forth to a four-dimensional interval and things. You know, it took an immense amount of work for people to figure out all the tricks. And frankly, I don't remember them all. You know, I've seen these things before, or others like them. And, you know, the route is just not all that well trodden, but they work to get from here to there. And then you actually make the prediction and actually measure stuff, and it works. So, anybody's got, oh, the next one's going to show up in 10 minutes. I got 10 minutes to answer.